Well, hey, everybody, it's the Week of the Tackle podcast, the podcast where we assess the previous week in the world of football and or soccer, delete as appropriate, and tackle the things we thought were interesting. I'm Tom Rennie. Alongside me is Apple and Sirius XM FC broadcaster, he of the salmon suit fame. It's Danny Brian Dunseth. How are you, mate? You all right?
I'm doing good, Rennie. I'm doing good. Back from Las Vegas, went down for Micah's tournament. Stayed at Resorts World and the Conrad. It's at the very top by Circus Circus, the dilapidated Circus Circus. Told a story to my kids. When I was 12, I played in this Las Vegas tournament coming up from Southern California. I stayed in Circus Circus. Clowns freaked me out. The carpet freaked me out. And I think it's a little bit worse even now because my boys did a quick little deep dive on the old, I don't know why my hand's up, but it on their phones. And they said, Dad, a lot of people die at Circus Circus. And I said, another reason why we should not stay there. But Resorts World, man, if you ever make it to Vegas, it's at the very top of the strip. Very, very cool. We went and saw Cirque du Soleil Mystère on Friday night.
Oh. Yeah, Rennie. Amazing.
I've never seen it. My wife, Jade, had gone with her parents. We decided because it's the anniversary of her mother's passing today, 2 years now that's gone on, that we were going to do something for the kids and kind of make it like a fun little like side event within the event. Because she loved Cirque du Soleil. So we saw it. It is amazing. Highly would suggest going to it. So we did that on Friday. Micah made it all the way to the finals. Referee, really bad call, ended up giving the game to the other team. But
what was
really
the call?
Fun.
What happened? How did you react to it?
Well, there's football and there's anti-football. And I would say that all of a sudden, the team that he was playing against kind of turned to after the first half didn't go their way in the final. Five in the back, throw the big dogs up front, let them eat, you know, very direct. And they're kind of at that age group where Mike is playing up a year. He's a 2012. He's playing with 2011. So it's effectively under 13. So it's you're now at the noticeable size difference where like some kids have mustaches on armpits and other people are just little wee guys. So the athleticism and kick the ball up over the top and let the biggest guys run, the speedsters run, was a very prominent tactic, but I'm proud of the way Mason, the coach, and this team played because they move the ball around, ping the ball. It's really fun to watch them play. And unfortunately, they lost, but I don't know. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned in situations like that where you get a little bit more pulled away, and then all of a sudden, as you ramp up for the spring season, you're a little bit of piss and vinegar when it comes to training sessions because you know how close you need to how close you kind of were and how much more you need to be. But always fun, especially as you know, in the job that I have with Apple and the US men's national team, I'm gone a significant amount of weekends and I miss a lot of soccer games for my boys. So when I get to see these tournaments, we were in Mesquite, Nevada a week before. Now we did Vegas, and now the MLS season starts this weekend. I'll be down in Austin with Max Bretos for the start of the season. Yeah, it's always fun to kind of like have those moments where I can just be a soccer dad. And I got to tell you, Rennie, I was walking the fields at the Betty White complex in Las Vegas.
Oh.
And it was like 12 fields and parents are going nuts and games are happening, celebrations. I was just walking around. I just took it in for a second. I had this like very surreal, cerebral flashback to when I was a kid and just like how much. I don't know if it's the purity of youth soccer because it's not really that pure. But it was just something about like, oh, dude, I remember this smell of the grass and the sights and the sounds and the echoes and the screams and the yells and the yelps and the fuck you ref. Sorry, Tim. You know, all of those things. Yeah, it was a fun weekend to be a part of. What about you? What'd you do? What'd you get into?
Well, firstly, I love the idea of you being at the Betty White. Was it arena or park?
Betty White
it?
Complex, soccer
complex. Yeah. I love the idea of you being there. And in my mind, you're watching all these youth players playing and you're there with like a shawl over your shoulders with your giant glasses. Oh. And in the background, it's just like, thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. And you're just like hugging Blanche. Mm. So I imagine you're doing. I forget the rest of the actresses. Yeah. Well, Blanche would have done. Sorry, Tim. Oh, sorry, Tim, that one. Yeah, that's fine. What have I been doing? I went to, thankfully, I missed the West Ham Arsenal game, as you know, but I did go to watch the Everton Crystal Palace game on Monday Night Football, which was the biggest mistake of my entire life. I fully regret ever watching it. I don't know why I considered, like, I get the chance to turn these things down. And I was like, no, I'll go. Yeah, I'll go to that. Sounds like a fun day. Absolutely was not. And I want to talk a bit about Deitch Ball. Because it sounds a little bit like youth soccer is a bit like Deitch Ball. in a lot of ways, which I quite liked. There was expectation on us to win. No,
Deutsche.
There wasn't, my friend. There wasn't. But they essentially had the same tactics as your boys' opponents. Just get the big geezers up. Have you tried getting the big geezers on? Mm. And he gets about $2 million a year. So football don't change too much. And also, I'm looking forward to this weekend because I'll be doing live commentary Wembley Stadium of the Carabao Cup final, the Moose Cup final. It's going to be live around the world, Sirius XM in the USA. Every continent across the world will be taking our commentary, radio commentary. So wherever you're listening, I know we get listeners in Ghana, Nigeria, Dubai, weirdly Russia. You can get our commentary this weekend. So just check your local listings for that. Looking forward to it. It could be, and I might be in attendance for, and speaking to afterwards, the manager, Jurgen Klopp's last ever trophy in English football, potentially. So I'm looking forward to that. Listen, a few things I want to get through today on the show. And we try and keep you at a nice tight 40 minutes here. That's why we're back in the top 50, as we should be. I wanted to talk to you about Chelsea and Man United because we have talked about them a lot. Well, we talked about Man United a lot more, right? Yeah, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And last Monday, I went to the Crystal Palace game, Crystal Palace-Chelsea, and was reasonably impressed. Not like knocked off my seat impressed, but these footballers, you can tell. You know, when you watch them on the TV and they don't win, it's quite fun to like twist the knife on Chelsea. But when you watch Enzo Fernandez, and at Selhurst Park, by the way, to your point of what it's like to be young, you are so close. Like, you are so close to the point where there's a great thing about being in the media at Selhurst Park. There's the Homesdale Road end where the fanatics sit, and there's the bit where the media are, which is kind of opposite to where the TV cameras are. And you could just stand there having a chat. So I was having a chat to a couple of colleagues and a couple of other broadcasters in between the two stands. And literally Cole Palmer was like, get away, mate, because you're like in the way, because the Crystal Palace players go into the tunnel and the away players have to go past you to some sort of weird porter cabin. So I'm now standing in the way of all the Chelsea players trying to get back to their dressing room before kickoff. And that's where the mix zone is. It's probably the best mix zone in the league because you're essentially just mingling in a car park with the players. So it's cool. So even if you're not interviewing them and I'm not doing the kind of broadcast interviews, you end up having a bit of a chat or you end up just sort of like looking at them up close and you see that, wow, Axel De Zarzi's a big guy, isn't he? Wow, that's a mountain of a man. Whereas Cole Palmer, you know, he has no muscle tone. I can't believe he's a professional footballer. He is just like a selection of lolly sticks glued together. So anyway, yada, yada, yada. They get to the Man City game. Brilliant performance. De Zarzi was amazing. Melo Gusto was brilliant. And you're starting to get the vibe that it's just, it's not clicking fully. They lost to Wolves 2 weeks ago, but you're getting the feel, Chelsea, that things are starting to work out. Pochettino is finding his team. It turns out, as we always sort of predicted, a billion-dollar investment of top-quality, well-scouted players, even if they were overpaid for on ludicrous contracts, please don't mention amortization here, in the end, it may well come good. And so Manchester United, you know, they had massive injury issues for a long period of time. Marcus Rashford stopped scoring goals. Rasmus Højlund simply wasn't ready to be a Premier League striker August through January, even though I mentioned to you on debut. I was at the game when he came on against Arsenal. We had a show the next day, I think. And it was like, yeah, it's a raw bag of potential here. There's a good player to come, nowhere near ready, and shouldn't be Man U's number nine on that date, August 20th or whatever. But it's coming. And Dani, all of a sudden, both of these two teams, in different ways, against different opponents, with different issues to overcome, it feels like they're getting there now. And I kind of wish we'd done more jokes about how bad they were, because we might have to stop, I suppose. What do you
think? I blame you, because your focus was squarely right here, the bullseye, which was the front of my face, as Manchester United struggles with injury, form, fitness issues on and off the field. And the inability to communicate properly what was really happening, or choosing not to communicate properly. And now, even with Dan Ashworth, the direction, I would say the biggest striking difference for me is obviously what's happening on the field, right, for Manchester United, but more importantly, what's happening behind the scenes. Because with Ineos coming in and Ratcliffe putting Brailsford and Omar Barada and everybody in charge, now all of a sudden you have soccer people making soccer decisions. And I've always said, and I use this analogy with FC Cincinnati in Major League Soccer. FC Cincinnati kind of built the roadmap of how not to come into Major League Soccer. And then all of a sudden they pivoted because they won three wooden spoons in a row by being the league's worst teams. They went and they got Chris Albright from Philadelphia. He brings in Pat Noonan from Philadelphia. And all of a sudden these guys get everything right, virtually everything right. I mean, outside of Columbus beating them in the semifinals and hosting this last season. So,
but that can happen.
They can. It's a game.
Yeah.
But what's exciting for Manchester United is that there's finally, for the first time, basically since David Gill and Sir Alex Ferguson departed the club, that you have soccer people in soccer positions making soccer decisions, right? And then you still have the commercial aspect, which is the powerhouse and the titan and the heavyweight in that conversation as well. So whatever the effect, we knew what the cause was, but we didn't know what the effect would be about this decision and about how long it took and how we're getting there. But Erik ten Hag and having the full complement roster of players, it's starting to look something more similar to some of the things that we saw last year. So whatever that looks like, okay, we plan it, we leave it. Chelsea, on the other hand, is a completely different conversation, bag of potatoes, as you said, because I think the reality is that when you have potential, an extraordinarily talented group of players, the reality is that they're still immature in a lot of ways. And I think the maturity level in this conversation is this performance against Manchester City shows what they are capable of. And at the same time, it's easy to get up for games. When you are a real contender, it's easy to get up for the big games. Even when you're the little, I would say, sorry, strike that. At any point, if you get to play Man City, that's your chance to shine. This is a big dog. So I would say for Liverpool, I would say for Arsenal, same thing. Okay, Chelsea, show up, play, show what you're capable of. Let's go. Come on, guys. We know what we're capable of. That's easy. Roddy Raw. When you're playing Sheffield United, you're playing Luton Town, when it becomes a little bit more tricky, when you're playing Everton, when you're playing Wolves, all of a sudden, you become the team that's expected to win. And that's a completely different role reversal, especially for a more youthful, exuberant type of player. So I think what we're seeing is two things. One, we saw the target on Manchester United because it's Manchester United, is low-hanging fruit. The target was less talked about and more joked about with Chelsea because of who they've been for the last 18 months. And because it's really easy with Clear Lake and with Igbali and Boley and everything that's transpired, that ha 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 ha. And now it's like, ooh, I mean, yeah. And I remember when people said, we'll give them 3 years. And it's like, well, no, this is now. We have to be talking now. We can't be talking 3 years. So the immediacy shows us potential. And that's the scary part with Chelsea, if you're a Chelsea fan, is you have no idea what kind of performance you're going to get. They could be incredibly high, or they can be incredibly average, or they could be just smack dab in the middle, which is effectively where they're at in the Premier League table.
Two questions for you from these two games. Number one, on Manchester United, they beat Luton this weekend. It was a tight affair in the end, as all Luton home defeats are. I think just three wins all season, but so many times losing by the odd goal in three or odd goal in four, whatever it ends up being, odd goal in five even. It keeps on happening to them. So played well, but in the end, they coughed up a couple of terrible early goals. But Man U probably could have won it by four or five missed chances. Anyway, Gary Neville post-match talked about the Ratcliffe effect and whether the things you mentioned earlier on, football people coming in, sports people coming in, hopefully no more conversation of the Glazers. Don't at me, folks. All right, don't at me. Even though I was right there, then I'm right now. Do you think, and you've played, as well as analyze these things, do you think Ratcliffe coming in, Brailsford coming in, Dan Ashworth coming in on gardening leave right now, Erik ten Hag clearly being given, if not a vote of confidence, then the nod to continue, we're going to end that speculation now, all of that, do you think that aids the performances we have seen over the last couple of weeks? Or do you think that players like, man, I don't care, like the players are back, we're playing?
I would say it's probably right down the middle. But what I would say is that what happens when you felt like you've been done wrong or that your teammates have been done wrong in the past, it sticks around. And I could effectively tell you every bullet point of moments throughout my career where I felt as if someone had done harm to either me in real time or irreparable harm to my career long-term based on decisions that they made. And I held grudges. And I would make sure that everybody around me knew how much I hated that motherfucker. Sorry, Tim. And that's you know, it's just it's every walk of life. It's every business situation. It's every school situation for kids out there, high school, college. You know, when someone like disrespects you or you feel disrespected by somebody's actions, their emotions, their decision making, you do hold that grudge. It's hard to let that grudge go. So yes, I do think in a way there was a factor, whether you're talking about Woodward, or you're talking about Arnold, or you're talking about Murtaugh, you're talking about whoever behind the scenes, the Glazers, promises, agent affiliations, conversations, all of that representations, all that trickles back into the player. So I would say that I would assume that when new people come in, it's like, yeah, that guy's fucking told you, man. Good. Yeah, he's out. Sorry, Tim. Like, yep, he's done. And then this new guy, all of a sudden, it's fair play. It's open season. It's like relationship time. It's hee-hee, ha-ha, give me a hug. What's up? Oh, hey, what's up, dude? High five. Do we bones? Do we hand? Do we do the awkward hug? I'm not sure. Like, do we just shake? Like, every, you know, so now it's for Ennios, for Brailsford, for everybody behind the scenes, it's a blank slate of feel good. Like, it is, it could always be worse, but I think that it is the ideal time for them to come in and just start from scratch and set the atmosphere. So I do think, to your initial question, it does have an effect, and it's a positive effect. There's going to be very little negative effect by them coming in because they don't really have a space in the game outside of what PSG, Juve, and potentially Newcastle. So we don't know what other relationships are there, but I would say that it is 100% beneficial. Much like I would say with Pochettino coming in preseason and setting the tone and a clean slate for everybody, who's in, who's out. Once he gets his hands on his players, that's his opportunity to put his best foot forward.
Yeah.
But I would say for Erik ten Hag, I would agree with you. We can put this to bed. Outside of negative results, we can put it to bed that he's absolutely going to be Manchester United's manager through the end of the season.
Yeah, unless something disastrous happens, but I think it's unlikely now. One final question on these two games and these two teams and these two clubs that I think we've all enjoyed berating in the last 18 months or so. I'm going to miss it.
Some more than others.
Yeah. Yes, the majority of the world more than others.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about Axel Di Sarsi and relate it a bit to Thiago Silva's wife. Last week, we had the whole Instagram thing. Not what you think. Calm down. And there's the whole, like, you know, essentially, I want Pochettino out. We lost against Wolves, yada, yada, yada. That was broadly what she was saying in her grand message, for which she then apologized. Thiago Silva then gets injured against Crystal Palace and is unable to play against Man City. He wasn't dropped. He was injured. Axel Di Sarsi this season, my colleague and friend James from TalkSport, big Chelsea fan. And he, like most people, have been calling him Axel Disaster because A, it works as a pun, and B, he's not been particularly good at times. In this game against Man City, 16 clearances, four of his four duels won, most with Erling Haaland, and the most blocks in the game. He was compared by some, only in terms of the game, not as an overall character or performer, to John Terry. And I think in terms of that one game, it's an accurate and fair comparison. And a tough thing to keep rising to Di Sarsi. And the reason I'm thinking about it in terms of the Bell Silver Graham is that Thiago Silva shouldn't be playing Premier League football at near 40, certainly not in a back four and certainly not in this team. I think that feels evident. Axel Di Sarsi has been thought of as a disastrous £40 million plus signing by Chelsea fans. I'm indifferent to Di Sarsi one way or the other. Don't think he's been great. Don't think he's been awful from what I've seen. But do you think there's an opportunity here to see Di Sarsi, and maybe did Di Sarsi see this as an opportunity to think, right, he's gone, he shot himself in the foot, he is now injured, someone has got to step up here. And he took that opportunity. Do you think there is a chance that's built on? Did it inform this performance? Or is that irrelevant to a young man trying to make his way in the Premier League?
Well, I think we need to point out he's not a young man. He's 25 years of age. So he's
compared to Thiago Silva, they're all young men.
100%. But how do I verbalize this? I agree with what you say. He's young with regards to experience in Premier League, but he's 25 years of age. And so I think we just got to, like, be not you, but in general, because a young player is 17, 18, 19, 20. Like, that's a young player in Premier League standards. Like, Phil Foden is no longer a young player, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, even Cole Palmer, as this season ends, I would say he's no longer a young player. You know, when you're 23 to 27, this is your chance. Like, this is it. Like, I remember 25 and I was like, oh, dude, I'm like on the downslope to 30. like, I got to make as much money as possible. Like, this is my chance to break in the national team. Like, if I'm going to go to a World Cup, like, they're not going to lean towards a 30-year-old. They're going to lean towards, like, a mid-20s guy. So, like, these are the things that's in your mind. So, the interesting thing that I guess, kind of assume from the outside looking in is you have this, you know, father figure type in Thiago Silva that's won everything. Like, his knowledge, his information. Like, if I was a young player, I would like try to sit next to him every single day just to ask questions, be around him, watch the professionalism, watch the attitude, watch the preparation, what he eats, what he doesn't eat, how he works out, how he doesn't work out. Is he doing Pilates and yoga, or is he doing strength training? Like, what are his little, like, what are his little bits and pieces that he brings every single day? But also, like, I can remember playing with guys like Dan Kalichman and Ivan McKinley and even Mauricio Wright, like guys that have played, like mainstay US guys, a South African, a guy who played for the Costa Rican national team, all incredibly different style of player. Francis Okora, he was a former Nigerian international, playing with Alexi Lawless. That was when Alexi had the beard and the goatee and the long hair and was like on every Powerade and Adidas and World Cup television show there possibly could. And I just remember, like, when they weren't playing, it was like, oh, it's my chance. Like, oh, okay, now it's my chance. Like, I get to be the leader. Like, I get to be the guy. And so I would be intrigued to understand, and because he's not my team, it's not my team, so he's not my player. I don't know the effective leadership background of De Sassi, so I wonder if he was a captain of the 17s or the 19th, because he's got that statuesque presence. He has that leadership presence. And he's had some really good games and he's had some hiccups. But I would agree with you, when the guy is out, you kind of like, oh, okay, like, you know, here we go. Like, yeah, Here's my chance. He's more than capable. I'll tell you that. He has his body type, his athleticism, his soccer brain, the way he sees things, he has every chance to be an elite center back. And I hope he's taken as much of an opportunity to glean as much internal existential knowledge that he possibly can from Thiago Silva.
I want to move on to talk about corners, because I love corners. I love
Me
them
too.
So much. And every team should score 25% or more of their goals from corners. A team should have a 1 goal in 10 corner deliveries average. And if you do, you're more than likely in a league season to be in the top half. You're more than likely in a title race to win it. If you're in a tournament, you're more likely to win that tournament. World Cups and the European Championships and all that sort of stuff are usually won by the team who scores the most set pieces. This season, the Premier League, I think this is true before this weekend, I'm not sure this is updated. Arsenal number one on corner goals this season with 11. Everton at 9. Tottenham have 8. West Ham and a few others have 6. Liverpool have 6. But the top two are Arsenal and Everton. Now, in the last couple of weeks, unfortunately, I did watch Arsenal's demolition of West Ham. Thankfully, I didn't go. I love those train strikes. I watched the Everton game against Crystal Palace, as I mentioned. Worked on it on Monday night. The goals they are scoring from corners feel to me so basic. Now, I'm not a kind of details, kind of data analysis person. I find XG hurts my teeth when we have conversations about XG. I know it's important and all that sort of stuff, but I do find it incredibly dull. But there's data men that are working on this. You go to a game now and there's always a row of about 9 people with laptops analysing the game moment by moment. It's interesting to watch. Anyway, Arsenal keep scoring goals from basically knocking the ball as deep as possible from a corner and someone heads it home. Everton, who were bloody awful against Crystal Palace on Monday, didn't get beaten and got out of the relegation zone. Why? Because they delivered a deep corner. I think it was McNeil, found Onana, who's 6'4", and he scores at the back post. Everyone is treating this like, I don't know, it's a new Harry Potter book. It's like, wow, what is this? Genius. You must have worked hours on this. Is this a secret code as created by Einstein and Oppenheimer at Los Alamos? How did they come up with this idea? And it was knock it in deep to the big geezer at the back stick and you can't stop him. And I just wondered, from your experience, right, can this be stopped? Like, Sean Dyche has made a career of doing this goal. Yeah. Everton are now doing it, and Arsenal are competing for the Premier League title off the back of scoring this goal. Why is it so effective offensively, and why is it so hard to stop defensively?
So I would say there's two ways to cut this up. Number one, I think we're still in a generational gap where that idea of lump it long, knock it down, get in the mixer, put it in the mixer is still applicable to 2024 football. And at the same time, I think there's enough teams that have the financial infrastructure and the ability to have set piece coaches. And whether that's, you know, set pieces from distance or those are corners, now it's about trickery, right? Straight. Oh, we'll see something happen and some guy peel off and like straight off the training ground, you know, that goal, you know, like the creative. So I think what you're seeing is more and more specifically those teams that already is like very visually, tactically, you can see exactly what they're doing, right? Everybody knows. So then the tightening the screws, the little finite terms between these games come down to how much more time are you spending either on finishing set pieces, penalties, all they're creating more time for these. Cause what it used to be, Tom, is be like, all right, Tim, you're taking corners, the outswinger from the net far side. Chris, you'll be hitting in swingers from the near side. Try to put it around the penalty spot. Okay, Alexi, Dunny, Francis, you guys are going to make the runs. Make sure you pick off somebody. We'll have somebody at the front post. Chris, you just kind of like sit on the goalkeeper and just kind of make it difficult. And then like, guys, got to be on your toes. Got to be proactive as opposed to reactive. That's what they say, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's just about movement. And I hate zonal marking. I'm more of a fan of an in-between front post kind of man-to-man with some zonal, which is, I think, what you're seeing more. Three guys kind of slide out past inside the penalty spot area, and then everyone kind of like arcs the six, and everyone's kind of responsible, which I still think is you're flat-footed. I don't know. Momentum.
Yeah.
Trajectory. That's just me.
They're sprinting, and you're not. You're in trouble.
Athleticism. But I like the battle. I'm more of like a grip and hold, and like I just like that stuff. So I think those two have to be acknowledged. But what I would say is there's just some guys, and I don't know how to explain this. We all kind of, when we played, we all knew who was really, really good on corners. And I'll give you an example. Carlos Bocanegra played for Fulham, captain of the U.S. men's national team. We're like 2 years apart. He's 2 years younger. I don't know how he timed it so perfectly, but he always had this instinct that he was on the end of a ball almost every single time. It was crazy. Or he was right in the mix, like when everybody came together. But he'd have like 6 or 7 goals a year from headers coming off corners. Whereas I wasn't necessarily, like I'd go get in the mix, no problem. But I had this like peeling effect where I would end up at the back post. It's what almost got me my goal in the Olympics is I peeled off, sit at the back post, ball came down, I hit it with bounce off my left foot, crossbar, post. They went the other way, got a penalty. At the close. But yeah, that, so I would always like look for the knockdown and kind of the back post tap ins, which if, you know, it was just dependent upon that. So I just think it's, you kind of match mentality with kind of technology and updated coaching with instinct. And I think that's why you're seeing the Arsenals and the Evertons surprisingly that much higher up. But I think if we ask Mikel Arteta, he would say we prioritize something like that as an important piece of what we're trying to do. Whereas maybe Deitch says, off his nails, mate. Put it in the mixer. Let's see what can happen.
Your Deitch is very Postecoglou. That was a little bit, there's a twang. There's a G'day, koala mate. Twang in there. It was nice.
Throw another shrimp on the barbie.
I'm not sure where that went. It just fascinates me, and I love watching all the kind of data analysis people and the people who are like po-faced watching the football, clearly not enjoying it, but they love the warmth of their laptop on their laps.
Can
and
I tell you what's really like happening? What's about to happen? So we're adding, so in MLS this year, we're adding set piece threat to the equation.
Yes.
And so it's going to be corners, free kicks. It's going to be like a predictive taking the predictiveness of what's transpired over the last 5 to 10 games for each team and talking about giving them like the, to your point, Arsenal's set piece threat would be extremely high where Manchester United's would be very, very low.
So would you be saying there's a 38% chance that Gabriel will score from this corner because yada, yada, yada?
Based on this season, Gabriel has a 38% chance on this corner, and keep an eye on Gabriel or keep an eye on Ben White. He's actually at 28% as well. So these two are going to be the primary targets on service for Arsenal. something like that. So it becomes more of like a predictive moment, like who to watch, where it could, because with corners, I would say, keep an eye on the matchup between, you know, Josh is marking Chris. Chris has got 5 goals this year off corners. That'll be the one that you really want to pay attention to. Mm. Or historically, this outswinger, we've seen Seattle really focus on the back post. And so that's where you'll usually find Jackson Reagan hovering. Something like that, to where I think what we're trying to use is more analytics with more predictiveness, which then, like, hey, keep an eye on this, and kind of trying to sound smarter.
I love the idea of you now being at stadiums doing the commentary of games. And with all the analysis you've got, and you were telling me about some of this off air before we started recording, I love the idea of you now being like Tom Cruise in Minority Report, just like corner right? Kick, move it around. I'm just moving this in here. And you've got a ball, you've got to pick the. Yeah. I just love that idea. You'll have your own little leather gloves with your fingers out, and you'll be like, bring the stat in, move that out there. Yeah. Looks like Gabriel's going to push a corner. Just rewind it live.
You know what's going to happen? Instead of that, it's going to be me drawing a yellow line with an arrow. That's
what it's going to be. To the goal. To the goal.
Attacking this way.
Yeah.
Left to right.
We're going to get too technological, and then we're going to go back to some guy with a stick. There's a few other bits I want to get to, and I don't want to run out of time, and I do want to do a brief soapbox, because I do think this will probably be the last, hopefully, conversation we have about West Ham for a while. But this weekend was another weekend where they just couldn't. They lost against Nottingham Forest, and that is not inherently interesting. The game itself is not inherently interesting. Calvin Phillips getting sent off is quite amusing in a lot of ways. And to be fair, if Calvin Phillips, and I think it was right he got sent off because he didn't make contact with Gibbs White, it doesn't mean it wasn't a stupid tackle. Yes, it's bad that Gibbs White put sauce all over the goose, but, you know, that's the game. It is frustrating, though, that the following day, Casemiro actually does make contact and doesn't get his second yellow.
But should have been sent whatever. Off, yeah.
That's the game. That's the way it goes. What did annoy me a little bit, and I got to admit that I did kind of indulge myself a little bit in the old ways, a little bit on Saturday night, because I was on a rail replacement bus on the way home, and I was really bored. And I'd just done the commentary of the late game, and I'm on a bus, and it's 9 p.m., and I'm like, oh, I've got to get through this. Rubbing the temples, sitting on a bus with randos in the rain. And I posted a couple of tweets, we still call them tweets, about the banner. And the banner annoyed me, I've got to say. If you haven't seen it, a small group of West Ham fans, 3 or 4 of them, held up a banner, which they'd pre-prepared, which they had made at like the British equivalent of like a Kinko's or something. It wasn't like a bed sheet. It was a sort of professional looking Moyes out banner. And 4 other people held up essentially like PDF saying Moyes out, 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 right? And it's still not the overwhelming position of West Ham supporters. I think it's still pretty evenly split, though the way that recent results have gone, you know, yada, 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 I think it probably leans more towards Moyes going. Fine, whatever. I don't have an issue with that. And as we discussed previously, I have no issue with people leaving early, voicing their opinions, shouting, going on the radio, going on the telly, having a fan TV channel, saying he's a wanker, whatever you want. That's absolutely fine, right? I don't mind any of that sort of stuff. But the banner for me was a bit too much. It was too much for me because David Moyes, when he does leave, and it looks like it might be in the summer, who knows, will leave. As you know, I have conflicting feelings a lot of the time, but in the macro of it all, when he leaves, he will maybe be the best manager that West Ham have had in my lifetime. Certainly not in terms of watching the football at points, but in terms of success and Prague and all of that, he does deserve credit in the macro. In the micro, it's very tough to watch, and I've said this to you loads of times. Even when they win sometimes, I feel a bit empty and unenthused about it because it's awful to watch, right? Fine. But that's a conversation to be had, and that is ongoing. The banner was designed, I think, to humiliate him. And I just don't find that acceptable. I think there are times the banner should come out. Those times are bottom of the league. Those times are being moved from your traditional stadium to an Olympics track when you're not being consulted on it. When you hate the owners, or there's been a lack of investment, or a company is taking profit out of the club when you want it invested in the team, blah, blah, blah. When Avram Grant, the biggest chancer in all of soccer history, takes your club down with 20 points. Absolutely, I'd be holding that Grant out banner up in the air. But I don't think David Moyes deserved that. And I really took a beating on social media from a lot of people on Saturday saying, no, he did. He did deserve it because of this, that, and the other. Mm. And Danny, I just wanted your thoughts on it a bit, because I feel like I'm right. Obviously, right. I think I'm right. I don't think David Moyes deserves that. I don't think he's in the same category as someone like Avram Grant or, you know, what Frank Lampard probably would have got at Chelsea if he wasn't a Chelsea legend, you know, for last season, that sort of stuff. And a lot of fans didn't agree with me. They see that as their only way to voice opinion. But I also felt a bit like they were speaking for me, which I didn't like. I think at this point, the conversation is clear. The debate is ongoing. The decision isn't made. You shouldn't humiliate someone who then did obviously feel defensive and said post-match, well, we did win a trophy in June. Like, what the f*** else have you achieved without me? You know, which seemed fair. What did you make to it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I agree with both sides, and I don't mean to be, you know, straddling the fence on this. I think that you absolutely have to respect what David Moyes has done with West Ham and lifting the Conference League trophy. But at the same time, I would probably argue that Unai Emery and Aston Villa absolutely have to win the Conference League trophy this season. Just because of the power and the weight behind the wages and the names on the back of the jerseys and the fact that you're a Premier League team playing in that tournament would suggest that you are absolutely the favorites. So I think it would be a travesty had West Ham not won the Conference League. Can't believe I hadn't done it yet. So I get Moyes' point. This team is safe as safe can possibly be. But now you've tweaked expectations. And when you've tweaked expectations, the immediacy of results comes into the conversation. And it's the inevitable debate that you and I have had, whether it's been WhatsApp or it's been on Grumpy Pundits or it's been here on Week in the Tackle, is can he be a little bit more attack-minded? Does he always have to revert to this system? Is he too rigid? Is he too stubborn? Why is he playing an outside right back as an attacking left midfield when what did they do in the transfer? Well, why? But no, hold on. But they don't have to do. But I mean, I know it's gonna be effective, but like they're too good of a team. Like, are you putting them in a box that they shouldn't be in a box? Like, why is this? It feels like, you know, a square peg in a round hole because this team's so much better than the way that you're playing. Like, you're playing for safety as opposed to being expansive and proactive and fun and exciting. And I think this gets into the same conversation that we were having with Roy Hodgson and Crystal Palace when compared to Brighton 2 weeks ago. And now we're looking at Unai Emery, and we could say maybe that we've said the same thing about like Erik ten Hag and Manchester United. What you're saying isn't matching up to what we're seeing on the field of play. So I get both sides, but where I have a problem with David Moyes is where that is a reality-based 100% factual statement. Fans don't give a shit about that. Sorry, Tim. Fans want to be entertained. And it's funny, one of Micah's teammates went over and saw Premier League games throughout a weekend. They went to Stamford Bridge. They said, oh my God, this is incredible. They went to the Bowl of Disappointment and they sat with the Bournemouth fans. And they said, the words that the children learned were much more exciting than what they saw on the field that day. And they said they learned new words. They learned new songs and they learned new hand signals to let people know.
Is he saying country? Country? Yeah, something like that. Something like that. Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's, and I think, again, you and I don't know like the training structures and the ideals in which David Moyes has to make sure these boxes are checked. And it's almost the opposite, right, of say a Pep Guardiola, and it's completely apples and oranges conversation, but like Pep Guardiola is as rigid as could be because he would rather lose playing his way than play, and you know, whatever, not that Moyes is playing anti-football, but anything that doesn't check all the boxes of how he sees
different
the
style,
game needs
yeah,
to play. So again, we come back to the same conversation that we were talking about last week with Roy Hodgson and now Glasner coming in. No problem. End of season, you want to replace David Moyes. You want to go in a different direction. Who is the right manager for this squad is the conversation that you made last week. I said, it's tough when you see guys like Graham Potter, and you said, hold on, here's the list of players that would never play under Graham Potter, and that's majority of our starting 11, and there's nothing to suggest that West Ham is willing to go out and spend the money to bring in Graham Potter type of players. So back to the original question, Tom, he's right, he's wrong. What the future looks like, I would suggest that someone else needs to be in charge of this team to start next season. but I couldn't give you a name that would fit this roster of players and what the future investment looks like.
I mean, they're literally listing Julen Lopetegui, Graham Potter, and Steve Cooper. And therein lies your answer as to why David Moyes remains manager. I just think it's not banner time. You know, I agree with everything you just said. I think you're absolutely spot on. And you've covered it better than most West Ham fans have. But the banner is too soon. It's not right. It's not the right time. Listen, we are out of time on this show. But really briefly, Danny, I did want to ask you about MLS. We began there. Mm-hmm. Let's end there. A new season gets underway. You're about to go back on planes, trains, and automobiles for the next few months. We've got the OAPs of Inter Miami against young squads across the country. Columbus Crew defending MLS Cup from last season. 3 stars on the jersey. Love the jersey, by the way. But I did want to ask you briefly about what's going on with the referees. Are you going to be in charge of a few games here? What's happening?
Yeah, no. It's a tough one, right? You have Major League Soccer and pro referees, and you have a lockout with the PSRA right now. There was basically a collaboration in terms of trying to get the player, the referees back on the field. Representation had agreed on basically a rough outline of what Pro wanted and what PSRA wanted. And then when it was sent to the membership, which are all the referees, which are center referees, ARs, fourth officials, AVARs, VARs, they elected roundly, I think it was like 95% to say, nope, no, thank you. There is a way to kind of work through the situation and still have the negotiations, but they felt they wanted to stand strong and in unity. Listen, less than ideal. The start of the season, there was a bunch of new things that were going to be rolled out, including when a referee was going over to the monitor for VAR, then he could turn. He had a live mic and he would then tell the entire stadium what the decision was and why the decision was made. So everybody in stadium had basically the same opportunity as those watching to understand what the decision was, what the call was.
Picks the mic up like he's doing cabaret. It's going to be
so it's basically, it's like football. I don't know if you've seen that. There's a little mic pack on the side. There'll be a mic here.
It's like a switch or something.
Yeah. Right. After review, after VAR review, the decision on the field stands. He's in an offside position. You know, number 14 is in an offside position when the ball was played in. So then it'll say like offside or not offside or goal stands or, you know, so then that's what we've always talked about. How are we not punishing those fans that spend the money, put their butts in the seats to have the game, but still understand what's happening?
But the backup refs aren't going to be doing that.
Well, what they're doing right now is they basically the referees that will be refereeing the first tomorrow night, Inter Miami against Real Salt Lake, and then the first MLS weekend, they're going to scale back a couple of the things that they planned on implementing, just because these are a lot of referees that have reffed at a good level, but they're not trained fully in what this season was supposed to be. This whole
are
thing.
Are they like college soccer or what are they? Where are they
so
from?
You'd
are
have
they,
a bunch of...
Are they scabs? Are they union scabs?
Well, effectively, that's what they're going to be termed, but you're going to have college referees. You're going to have some that have USL referee experience. You'll have some that are from overseas that will be brought in. I think the rough estimate was somewhere between 70 and 85 referees are kind of within this list that will be chosen for their specific jobs. As of right now, I've not seen the referees that have been put on each individual game to do a deep dive. Like, for example, Max Brados and I will have Austin FC against Minnesota United. We don't have the referee information because that's going to be one of the things that we're going to want to reference in the beginning is, okay, here's the experience of the referee. What we've been told is VAR will be competent. It will be VAR trained referees. So they will be able to utilize VAR and be as seamless as possible in terms of the information, the replays, looking back at the goals, onside, offside, foul, you know, all the immediacy. But yeah, listen, again, not ideal for either side. Yeah. I can understand both sides. I can understand what reality and what kind of the wistfulness of hoping is. At the end of the day, both sides will end up coming together, hopefully sooner rather than later. Similar to what we've seen, I think it was a similar situation back in 2000, either 13 or 14, if I'm not mistaken. Cooler heads prevailed. Everybody worked to get on the table. I think in my mind, you're going to have a bit of maliciousness with the first weekend with the referees that are not participating and the idea of like, hopefully there's mistakes. So then MLS can kind of come or pro can come back to the table, have a little bit more leverage. But at the same time, if the referees do well enough, and we've seen this, a couple of referees that were replacement referees ended up becoming full-time referees because their performances were so good back then, 2013, 2014, that all of a sudden it'd be like, all right, cool. But like, maybe because you're digging in your heels so hard, maybe you've lost a little bit of leverage now, and that becomes a little bit more awkward. So yeah, I don't know. I think what we're continuing to see is the growth and the evolution of growth, not only in Major League Soccer and US soccer, but also with the referees, college soccer, and everyone wants a bigger piece of the pie. So we'll see how it all turns out.
Classic MLS in the start of the season. There's no refs. I love everything about this story, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. And I hope MLS have sent out a memo to all the broadcasters saying, don't worry, VAR will be competent. We'll see how that works out across the weekend. Yeah, maybe think of a new title. Danny, good luck this weekend, mate.
Cheers.
Enjoy the game. I'm sure the call will be good live on Apple TV. Subscribe now. Get your MLS package. And you can also hear me do the Community Shield with our TalkSport international team on Sunday. Check your local listings for that. This has been the Week in the Tackle podcast. Brian Dunsif over there. Me, Tom Rennie. Tim Horsey produced the program. If you listen as a podcast, you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello. You can also subscribe as a podcast. We'll see you next week.